Session number 26359.
Colonel Robbins, Reel 6. So
having captured the highest point in Normandy by the 43rd Wessex Division, the Wiltshires got to the top first. The 5th Wiltshires came out, as I said, with the adjutant, who was again wounded within half an hour of us passing through him, came out with 2 officers and 80 men out of 600. And after the Battle of Pinson, we were all gathered in a field for a rest, a couple of hundred yards away. The Germans still counterattacked the place. The battle wasn't just over like that. And General Horrocks, who was the corps commander, we were told, wished to speak to us. He wished to speak to the 129 Brigade, that's the 2 Wiltshires and the Somersets, for this battle they'd just won. And we were in a field, we'd had a rest, we'd had a meal, and he drove up in his jeep, got out, gather around men, and we did. And he said, "You are the best I've got. I am so pleased that that battle you have just won." And you could see the men who were so tired, so holding themselves up, standing up straight. And he said, "You were I promised you a rest after this battle." "Well," he said, "I am so pleased with you, I'm putting you into battle again tomorrow." And before we realized what he'd said, he drove off. "Goodbye, men," and drove off. We didn't realize he was sending us in again. Well, it wasn't much. We advanced again. And that was the time when the Americans were coming down from Cherbourg in the big sweep there, and the Canadians and ourselves this way. And we were all aiming at Falaise. They call it the Falaise Gap. There was a gap at Falaise through which the remainder of the German army escaped. And we drove through a lot of that towards there, where we saw the terrible carnage of a fleeing enemy. Our Air Force had spat at the lot. Burnt out vehicles, dead men, dead horses and carts. It was a terrible scene, and so many thousands captured. But still many, many escaped. And they escaped south to the River Seine, where they took up position of defence. And again, the 43rd Division were told, "You will go forward and cross the Seine. You've got to get that bridge. It's the way for the army to get into Europe." And that was our next move, in which we drove forward towards the Seine and got to a place called Vernon. Vernon's a lovely little town on the Seine, and there are 2 bridges, a railway bridge. No, not 2 bridges, I think it's a road bridge across to a little village called Vernonette. And that was our objective. We got to the village and entered it, and the French were ecstatic, greeted us. "The war is over," they shouted, and they gave us flowers and wine and everything they could, friendship. And we were surprised. We got down to the river's edge. The bridge had been blown. So that meant that the sappers had to be called forward to rebuild it with a Bailey bridge. We wanted the whole British army to get across there with their tanks and guns. We also had to cross, and we were told to get across. And we looked across the Seine, and opposite were cliffs, and on the top of those cliffs were German defences. And they were going to stop us getting across. They held the other end of the bridge. They held that little village, and they had put defences on the cliffs overlooking the River Seine. We were told to make a night crossing, and we had things called ducks, big cumbersome boats on the back of lorries which we'd brought forward knowing we'd have to do this. And they were quietly brought down to the edge. Every now and again the Germans would fire at us from the other side. French didn't seem to care. They were so happy to find the Germans had left them and the British were in. But it was still the odd shell and certainly machine gun fire coming down from the other side. The French were unbelievable. They invited the commanding officer to a dinner, which he had to refuse, of course. And they were making friends with the soldiers and so on. The 5th Wiltshires were ordered to go across first. And at night, they crossed on the right-hand side. They launched these boats. And on the left-hand side were the Somersets. My battalion, the 4th, were in reserve, waiting to see what would happen. The 5th Wiltshires slid their boats into the water and got halfway across when machine guns opened out on them from halfway up the river where the Germans had put a boat with machine guns on. Also, when they landed, the bit of land they were on was heavy defended by Germans. And most of that company, A Company, was written off, sunk in the water, or shot as they got onto the land. That was not a good start. Another company was put in to reinforce them. On the left, the Somersets, who had not studied the air photographs too carefully, landed their boats, fixed their bayonets, boats hit shore, up they came, ran into the land, and after about 25 yards, fell off the other side into the water. They'd landed on an island and hadn't spotted it. So they had to start again.
Where were you at this time? Were you getting any news or intelligence of what was happening?
We were watching at night as what we could. Mm. And my battalion was in Vernon, this side of the blown-up bridge. Mm. Couldn't get across it until these two companies had defeated the Germans on the other side.
Did you have any idea what was happening at the time? Did you get any...
Yes, we did. Yeah. We knew that they were being strongly opposed.
Right.
And we wondered what was going to happen. Eventually, the 5th Wiltshires did get more men across, and they did capture, well, about 20 of them were caught, actually, and taken prisoner, but they did get across, and the Somersets eventually got across the other side. And when dawn broke, that was the night crossing, we were on the other side, and the Germans had retreated up the hill or been defeated. And the 4th Wiltshires were to get across the bridge, which was broken, and we had to sort of clamber there, try not to fall into the water. It was like going on an obstacle course because it was blown up. Meanwhile, the sappers were steadily putting their Bailey Bridge up, which was up in the course of a day or two, again under fire. When the 4th Wiltshires got across, we were told to branch out to the right and go down the Seine And the Worcesters and another battalion were told to branch out to the left and go that way, so that the whole of the Seine would be free of Germans for the rest of the army to get across safely. The 4th Wiltshires found opposition going along the right. I remember going, I was on the bank, and we came to the village of Giverny, which was about 3 or 4 kilometres down that road, and that was defended by the Germans. So we had a bit of a fight for that. Another company got up on the cliffs where I said the Germans were, and they were attacking up there. All in all, the Germans didn't put up as fierce a fight as I thought they would for that area. And after a couple of days, we had got the Seine. When we went into Giverny, the Germans withdrew farther down the lane to a place, 10 kilometres, to a place called Roche-Guyon, which is where Rommel had his headquarters for the Battle of Normandy. And it is from that place where he ventured out in his car that I think a British aeroplane shot him, wounded him. When we got into Giverny, the colonel fortuitously made his headquarters in a house there with a lovely garden and so on. And it was the house of Monet, the great artist. And the French told him that this is the artist's house. The Germans were here. They had, funnily enough, the Germans had not looted anything. There were still some pictures there. And my colonel said, not even a paintbrush will be looted from this place. And we didn't take anything. We stayed in that area for 10 days. While the whole of the British army surged forward and up through France and Belgium, Brussels, and we had a couple of weeks' rest, during which time we were able to make one visit to Paris, which the Americans, of course, got into, and we'd allowed General de Gaulle to go into first. And they were dramatic days. But the Battle of Normandy was over, the Seine had been crossed, and we were told that there was a great battle plan to end the war in September by a massive airborne drop of 3 divisions, 2 American and 1 British, on various bridges leading north to the Ruhr and beyond. And our job was to, when the airborne had captured the bridges, to go through and into Germany.
While you were having a rest there, I mean, were the men just, I mean, was there any routine to the day, or were the men just allowed to sort of do as little as possible?
They were told, discipline was never dropped. There was always a parade in the morning. There was always weapons inspections. There were always make and mend of our uniforms and kit. And there was physical exercises, games, of course, and entertainment in the evening where one could.
How tired were they now? I mean, you'd had a...
Not, well, surprisingly, not as tired as I thought. So many, of course, had been killed.
I mean, there can't have been that number that had come all the way through.
No, that's true. I suppose 30% had got through.
Right.
Maybe 40.
Yeah. Did you see any, I mean, obviously there'd be, you get battle injuries and accidents and so on. But did you notice a sort of rise in less serious illnesses come upon people because they were tired or stressed or
you
sore
mean,
throats? And
I thought they were surprisingly fit the whole way. Surprisingly fit.
And what about mental health? Because obviously the shell shock and battle fatigue, or whatever you want to call it. You know,
didn't come across much of that. It was not regarded with much sympathy. And there was more of it as you got towards the end of the war. I never came across it till the end of the war. I often wondered whether I had it myself. Battle fatigue. Because right at the end of the war, I seemed to not care about taking cover. Funny feeling, that. Anyway, that was the end of another phase of the war, the crossing of the Seine,
yeah,
and that great ride up through France.
Yeah. And you went to Paris yourself, did you?
I went for one day with the company commanders and the colonel, and surprisingly, it seemed unaffected. Mm. You know, the women were nicely dressed and riding about on their bicycles, and the food was there if you wanted to pay for it, wine. And Paris was a strangely unoccupied place. There were many collaborators there, I suspect, and the Germans made friends with a lot of people. And the Americans went in strength. We didn't go into Paris much.
What did you think of the French civilians? Because it has been a difficult relationship, hasn't it?
In Normandy, many of the French civilians seemed to resent us coming because they found the Germans were considerate. Many of them made friends with them. Some of the women married them, I believe, or had relations with them. And so on. But all in all, they were always very, very pleased that we'd got there at last. But
did you feel you could trust the French civilians as allies, or would you be very guarded?
I think really one wanted to trust them, and I personally did. I spoke to them as friends. They didn't play much part in any battle. I never came across any marquee. I never did. Though once we came in there, a lot of French came forward and said they were marquis. Some were, some weren't.
What was your opinion of the Allied command, the generals? Did you have great faith in their master plan, and in Monty in particular?
I felt all right. I didn't really care for Montgomery. I didn't like him. And a lot of officers didn't.
Why was that?
I don't know. It was his attitude, maybe. I don't know. But those officers that he did like, he couldn't do enough for. He had that team of young men who were his aides. And they worshipped the ground he walked on. I personally felt, like many of us did, that General Horrocks was a more approachable, likeable man. And he was, unlike in the First World War, he was one of those generals who was right up in the front. And in this Second World War, generals tended to be up at the front more than they did in the First War, on both sides. I mean, Rommel was always up in the front. Von Rundstedt was frequently in the front. Horrocks was in the front. Monty was not unknown to be in the front. Eisenhower was the only general who never, ever got near the front. I don't know why. But there you are.
Did you meet any of them?
I met Monty, I met Dempsey, I met Horrocks, and so on, right down to my general. I didn't like my own general, commander of the 43rd Division. Mm-hmm. He was a First War artillery officer, and he did well in the First War, got a DSO. But the troops called him Von Toma, or Butch, because they thought he tended to throw the infantry in. Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But he was a very tough man. Well, you had to be a good general. Mm. Not lovable. Horrocks was different. Until Slim was very, very likeable in Burma. So there you are. You never can tell.
Mm. Did you meet Churchill? He did a lot of visiting, didn't he?
I never met Churchill. I once saw him at the end of the war in Hyde Park when we were all drawn up, and he didn't speak. Mm. He merely walked past. Mm.
Was he a hero to you or the
to the soldiers? Yes. Oh, yes, he was. Mm. I mean, he was number one, mm. without any doubt at all.
Mm. Mm. How much did you stay in touch while you were in Normandy in the early time in France? With home, did you correspond?
Yes, one did as much as one could. And also one had to censor letters which went through. It was a very difficult task, knowing what to cross out, you know. To say, we are now on the Seine. We had to cross it out. And there were flimsy sheets, you know, which you were given. You just folded them up and posted them, and it was all very, very easy. And, of course, one looked forward to mail from home. And that was a real morale booster.
And it usually got through, did it?
It got through. They did their very best to get it through and to get it up to the front line.
And what about when somebody was killed? You would have to write a letter, would you?
Yes. When someone was killed, always, company commander had to write to that man's parents or wife. A very, very trying experience. And, you know, you were tired yourself. Just come out of battle and you had to write this letter, or these letters. But it was a duty, and very, very right that it should be so.
And it was taken very seriously, was it? It was always done.
It was,
always did it.
Oh, yes, it would have been an awful confession of failure not to write home to someone who's... I've never known of any officer fail in that duty, which it was. It was an important duty.
Mm. And what about if it was friendly fire, or if it was perhaps they'd killed themselves? Mm.
I never wrote to those two men's parents who were removed, because they didn't die. And I never had anything more to do with them or their families. And I hope they were court-martialed, and I wouldn't have minded if they were shot. But no.
So I suppose, you always try and find... If it's friendly fire...
If it's friendly fire...
It's difficult, isn't it?
If it's friendly fire, I would keep it dark. For instance, I had to write a few letters on that first attack. Never did I say that they were blown up by their own... They were killed in action, in a bombardment. Better that way. It's a lie, of course. But it's better that way.
Did any parents or wives write back to you?
I've had one or two write and say thank you very much and for saying what you did about my son. One or two.
Yes.
Yes.
Because in a sense you were perhaps their last contact with the
regime. Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And the padre, you had a padre attached, I imagine.
Everyone had a padre. Each battalion had a padre. And they were very fine men on the whole. They didn't hang about at the back. They frequently came right up with the front troops. And many were killed.
Do you remember the names of yours?
I've got it written down. But see these books here?
Yes.
Those are my memoirs.
Oh, right. You're working on them.
But I get slowed up.
So how would, as a company commander, how would you use the padre? Would you call him in, or would you...
Before a battle, there was always a service. And surprising the number of soldiers who were not great churchgoers that would attend. And always, when he could, the padre would try and be there at a burial in the front line, if he could. Certainly in the rest areas, they were always there. And we put a great deal of store by our padres, who could have a very fine influence. Just as the doctor did. The padre and the doctor couldn't do without either.
The padre would have a sort of welfare sort of aspect to his work, I suppose, as well, wouldn't he?
I suppose he would, yes. Mm.
So a man might be more likely to go to him, might he, if he had a problem at home, you know, the wife going off with a butcher or something. Or...
Yes, I think he might. Quite often a man would speak to his officer, and the officer would quite often say, I think you ought to see the padre, he might be able to help you, which is really the way it happened. Very rarely did a man say directly, can I see the padre, sir? It happened always through his officer, which is the right way.
And the doctor, I suppose, would be seeing people who were reporting sick for whatever, and he would pick up some emotional needs, I imagine, as well.
Yes, he could. He'd pick up most things, like some of them were very careful, conscientious man, who would see that a man's nerves were. And he might even make some excuse to hold that man back for a day or two or from, but not often, and put him back.
Yeah.
But once he said, this man has got... They never used the word shell shock. Battle fatigue. Yeah.
I mean, bomb happy was the word.
Bomb happy was more the word. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they would send them back then.
Might, yes. But there's always a certain amount of disgrace attached to it.
Did you see the medical officer as an officer and part of the unit, or was he just an add-on?
He was definitely an officer of the unit. And played his part in everything. Very important, both the padre and the doctor. Very, very important.
Right. Colonel Robbins, end of reel 6.